Welcome, everyone, to the inaugural podcast by the University Libraries Office of Scholarly Communication Research Data Team, the Data Diversity Podcast. And we are happy to have with us one of our data champions, Danny van der Haven, to talk to us today about his relationship with data and all things data. So we have here with us today Claire Castle, the Research Data Manager for the Research Data Team in the Office of Scholarly Communication, Kim Cluxton, and myself as Research Data Coordinators with the Library. So, Danny, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for introducing me. I'm very happy to be here.
So let's start with a self-led introduction first. So please introduce yourself to the listener and your work as a data collector or a researcher.
So, as you know, I'm Denny, and I'm now a last-year PhD student at the University of Cambridge, working in the materials science department. And my PhD is very much with the physical data that you get from physics-like experiments. But in the past, I have worked on student competitions, and I've also worked with a startup involving tests with human participants. And in those cases, there was a very different array of data, very different from your typical physical experiments. And there's a lot more to consider in those cases. And it's also very different how you go about that compared to data that you just acquire in the lab. So through that, I also got more interested in the different aspects of data and how you manage that. And that's how I eventually ended up being a data champion also for the University of Cambridge.
So it seems then you had like these two perspectives of data and data work. What do you think is the difference between, say, research that deals with a lot of human participants and the other side of it, which I'm assuming is lab-based, in regards to your approach to data? What do you think is the key differences in this, and what are the sort of unique characteristics of both sides of data work, and also in terms of how you as a researcher you have to apply yourself?
Yes. So there are lots of differences, of course, but personally, what I find most striking is where you put the largest amount of mental effort. You get some overlap if you start to work with lab data because you're involved with a pharmaceutical agent, because then you get kind of this overlap between lab and human aspects because you start to work with medicine. But if I'm collecting data in the lab, physical data on powders or something, then I quite often have many more trial runs. I collect a few dirty data sets, data that's just, seeing if an experiment works or something. And you can do that as many times as you want. And then the main effort is in analyzing it. But when you go to dealing with human participants, you start to get a much stronger involvement of ethical aspects and regulatory aspects. And then there's a huge amount of work that comes before even collecting the data. And because there's such a huge amount of work before even collecting the data, because you have to store it securely, you have to make sure that you don't bother people too much, you're not too invasive. Because of that, you think much, much more thoroughly about what exactly you're going to record, how you're going to record it, before you actually do the measurement, so to say.
Interesting. So it almost sounds as if it's less fun in a way, would you say? I guess as a scientist, lab work maybe will come more natural to you. Maybe fun is not the right word, but there's more, there's more administrative work to be done in preparation for the collection.
Yeah, that's certainly true. The administrative work is there for good reasons to protect people. So I definitely understand that. And well, it doesn't necessarily have to be less fun. It's just, it's a slower paced. I think this is general also something that you see in experimental work versus computational work, so such as people doing simulations, that the work is the pace of the work is slower compared to that in computational science or such.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any interesting cases where you were faced with particular challenges in trying to get consent or attain human samples, etc.?
So I don't think the problem was particularly in getting the consent for the data in our case, because we were doing tests on an ergometer, so people do cycle tests, and then you tell them something about how thick they are. For example, you measure how much carbon dioxide they breathe out and how much oxygen they consume. So usually participants in those cases were quite content with just using the data. It's just that it's mainly that you start opening a whole kind of worms once you start looking at how you store the data and what you transfer. Because the hospital needs a copy of the data for regulatory reasons, because if something goes wrong, they need to go back and see, okay, what happened in this experiment. But at the same time, we needed a copy of the data to continue our research, to do our analysis. And we're also working together with Eindhoven University of Technology. So they also needed a copy of the data. So then you need to make sure that the data stays confidential and that everybody can reach it somehow, but that you don't have, of course, the problem that other agents that are not supposed to have the data end up having the data. So not everybody of Eindhoven is supposed to have the data, for example. And this is also where we ended up actually with a lot of discussion about what is data, in the sense that I think it's like they say it in some regulatory, in some rules, that like you should keep the raw data set more or less that you get from your tests with your participants. But then the question is, what is raw data? Because if you ask your doctor this, the doctor would just have given us a spreadsheet with, for example, heart rate per minute. But to us, like we were engineers, we were like, you know, no, if you're talking about raw data, I'm talking about the first number that comes out of the machine. If you got like a standard echocardiogram, no, electrocardiogram, sorry, then you have like 12 leads. So there are 12 electrodes. And each of those electrodes gives an electrical signal. So to me, the raw data is the electrical signal for each of those electrodes, basically. Because once you go to the heart rate, you've already processed it. But for the doctors, you know, it was like, okay, this electrical lead data, this isn't useful. This doesn't tell me anything. It's not real data yet. At least that's the impression I got.
So there's two things here I'd like to follow up on. One is you sort of answered it. You really begin to answer it, but I think there's more to consider, which is, again, is the question which I've mentioned in our discussion before that I want to ask every researcher that we speak to. That is, what is data to you? And before we get on to the answer, if, just to remind myself, I also want to ask about export control, because I think the idea of working with multiple bodies and also international bodies is starting to become an interesting consideration for us at the research data team. So we want to get an understanding of how you have dealt with it and maybe something that we can learn from you on that. So, yeah, first, what is data to you? I think you really sort of answered that as an engineer, it's signal, but then you've also had the chance to consider the human side of it in your presentation at the forum. There's also the commercial side of it and the policy side of it. So taking all that into consideration today, Danny, on Tuesday the 31st of October, what is data to you?
Yeah, well, I think I'm gonna go for a very general description that I think that to me, you have data as soon as you record something in any way. If it's a computer signal, if it's something written down in your lab notebook, I think that is already data. It can be useless data, it can be useful data, it can be personal data, it can be sensitive data, it can be, data that's not sensitive, but I would consider any recording of any kind already data.
Mm-hmm. So to use your context in particular, any reading on the device or the sensor that picks up the signal is the start of data, you would say?
Well, I would say...
Or even before, what you start planning and writing in your notebook, I suppose is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, yes, in that sense as well. So you mean the experimental protocol that you're trying to draft, I think that's already data. Mm-hmm. If you're measuring something, I don't think it's necessarily data when you're measuring it. I think it becomes data when you record it. So once you start putting it down, once it's, recorded, so to say. That's how I would look at it. Because that's when you start to have to think about the typical things that you need to think about when you involve the data or sensitive data or proprietary data and such.
Mm-hmm. Because one thing that really stood out to me in your presentation is what you said about how you define data largely decides a lot about how it's regulated. So I wonder if something like how you define data. So for instance, you say now that data begins when you, not when you measure, but, you know, beyond that, when it starts to make more sense than raw data, that's just a real start of the life of meaningful data, let's say. So what are the sort of different definitions of data that you have come across, and what have you seen? What are you seeing in the effect that it creates, and how it's regulated, how it's the kind of policies that apply to it, especially in terms of like commercial data that has commercial value?
Yeah. Okay, so that's actually quite a big question. So previously I gave a presentation at a forum on a small introduction on sensitive data, and there I said, okay, this is what I think sensitive data is. So, mm-hmm. So to me, data is something, as soon as you record something, I think that's data. But when you're talking about sensitive data, it's, I would say, any data or information of which the public disclosure or dissemination may be undesirable for a given reason, for any given reason. So that's where you then start to draw a distinction between data and sensitive data. And that's more my personal view on it. But there's also definitely a legal or regulatory view. Going back to the ECG, the electrocardiogram, I think if you would have the electrical signal from one of the stickers of a person, I think there is practically nobody that's going to call that personal data or health data. Mm-hmm. And most doctors wouldn't bat an eye. But once you start putting if you would put like the heart rates per minute that follow from the ECG, then it becomes not only personal data, but also becomes health data. Mm-hmm. Because then it starts to say something about your physiological state, your biology, your body. So that's when you start. There's a transition there that's not very obvious. Because the heart rate one is obviously health data, and the electrical signal from one single sticker is quite obviously not health data, I would say. But then where is that change, right? Because what if I have the electrical signal from all 12 stickers? You know, then I can calculate the heart rate data. So then from all the 12 stickers, suddenly I would start labeling it health data already. But for it to be that health data, you also need to know where the stickers are. So yeah, when is it held data? I would say that, you know, somebody with decent technical knowledge from these 12 stickers, if they know where they are, can already compute the heart rate. So then it already becomes health data, even if it's not on the surface, you know. And I think that a lot of times people don't think completely true in that. A similar point is like when metadata becomes real data. For example, your computer always saves the date and time you modified files and such. But sometimes if you have like sensitive systems or you have people making appointments, then, you know, even such simple daytime information can become actual sensitive data, but it really depends on the case scenario.
That's super interesting. So there's a different facet to it. So data is sort of defined by the person who understands data. So as you said, the more technical knowledge you have, the more you can make sense from a bunch of, you know, seemingly random figures, the more data can be meaningful to you, which is, I guess, the fear of machines understanding data in ways that the human can sort of make sense of in a single sitting, for instance. And it kind of reminds me of social media companies and sort of people who have sort of no discrimination against data, and they just want to collect everything and hoard everything, and then one day that data might make sense. So for instance, I could just get all your ECG data without necessarily knowing where exactly the stickers place, etc. It might not make sense to me today, but maybe in 10 years or 5 years, a certain technology is created that can actually tell somehow, maybe through, I don't know, some other sort of metadata, where that signal comes from, then the data can become relevant. So that's actually very interesting, especially when it comes to health and physiological data, I suppose, because I guess that's, as we continue learning as well, I guess even at the library, we're mostly interested with human data. Human data is where GDPR kicks in, sensitive definitions come in. But if it's, for instance, like what Claire and I have learned today, when it comes to physical locations or buildings, for instance, even though it seems like it makes us nervous seeing how much information is shared, but because it's not a human participant, we shouldn't really be concerned about it. But the thought has occurred to us, what if people can correlate it? I think one of the definitions of sensitive data, which really strike me as interesting, is when a motivated individual can put your data together, it becomes sensitive and requires anonymization. And the idea of a motivated individual is always interesting to me, because if I was just a lazy hacker and it's like, that doesn't make sense to me, but if I really wanted to make sense of this data for whatever criminal usage, and I'm really motivated and I can get 10 data sets or 100 data sets together to make sense of this one number, and then the idea of how to anonymize something, or what requires, what should be treated as something that requires anonymization, becomes very interesting. So yeah, back to your point, I suppose.
There's definitely, I mean, we struggled with that, because with our startup, IS Analytics, we also ran into the issue of GDPR, of course. And so in the Netherlands at the time, GDPR like was interpreted, so GDPR is Europe-wide, but it was interpreted by the Dutch government really strictly. So like if you want to use anonymous data or pseudonymized, but it was not anonymous. If you could in any way, however difficult, retrace the data to that person. So at some point we were saying, yeah, but I mean, some people are not seeing these possibilities, but just to pull it, to take it really far, if I would be like a hacker with infinite resources, I could say, okay, I'm gonna hack into the dataset. I see the moment the dataset was recorded, and then I can hack into the calendar of everybody who was with their GPS at the hospital on this day. And then I can probably find out who at that time was taking the test, and then it's like, yeah, I mean, is that reasonable? Is everybody ever gonna do that? If you put those limitations on data, because that is a very, very remote possibility, is that fair, or are you gonna hinder too much? Mm. I understand the cautionary principle in this case, but it did end up being a struggle for us in that sense.
Yeah, because conceivably data would then lose its value if you really go to the full extent on how to anonymize something, then you'll be data-less, really, because the only true way to anonymize is to delete the data, I suppose, or to protect the individual involved with the data is to...
Yeah, well, you can't. You're not allowed, because you need to know what data was recorded with a certain participant. Because if some accident happens to this person like 5 years later, and you had a trial with this human, you need to know if your study had something to do with that. You need to be able to look back if somebody. I mean, this is obvious when you're testing drugs. So in that sense, the university must have, the hospital must have a non-anonymized copy. They must. But if they have a non-anonymized copy and I have an anonymized copy, if you overlay the two data sets, you can trace back the identity. So this is, of course, where you end up with a deadlock, more or less.
I was just going to say that this is kind of where we feel a bit of a responsibility in terms of making people's data sets available to everybody, is that you can't possibly anticipate every situation in which that data could be used or misused. And I think that's one of the barriers also, maybe in particular disciplines, maybe in STEM more, but like worrying about what will happen to the data, you know, who will get hold of it, who can reuse it. But there's a limited amount that you can do about that. You have to, I suppose, where it's more obvious, you can kind of lock down on it, like the university is with the export control and, you know, to certain countries that you may be wary of, you know, certain types of data that could be used in weapon making and that kind of thing. But, you know, how do you possibly anticipate that? And it depends what other intelligence there is out there, I suppose. That's what the security people are for. But it, as you say, it's a fine line between restricting sharing altogether or accepting that there may be some risk to that. So it's a really interesting concept, actually. Sort of an ethical concept.
Yes, definitely. So I think that the main approach now, at least how I experienced it, was that you're extra precautious. So like when you set up a trial involving humans and you say we're collecting data, you have to define what that data is going to be used for, and you cannot use it for something else. So that's clearly like a restrictive way of dealing with it. And I think that when it comes to like health data, something like that, there are definitely good arguments for that to be warranted. But yeah, it's harder to foresee, of course, when you start going to, my research now is on powders. Like when it's like a lot of, like you need to have quite a lot of expertise to know how to use powders for something weaponized. And it's also a general science thing in that sense.
Can you go in a bit more detail, or at least in the ways that you can, about your research? Because I believe it's powders in Brazil is the what I learned from you, but I don't really know what that means.
Yes. Yes. So right now I work on pharmaceutical powders. So I do experiments and computer simulations of how pharmaceutical powders get compressed into tablets. So if you have aspirin or something, it starts as a powder, you press it into a tablet, and the tablets that you take. And it has to be pretty, it comes quite precise, because if the powder is too porous, it crumbles and it immediately dissolves. So you spike someone with a drug potentially.
Mm-hmm.
But if the tablet's too dense, you know, it's going to be like a brick. It won't dissolve. And, you know, you're not going to absorb the medicine. So yeah, that's the thing. But powders are physically really tricky to deal with. Like there's this, I don't know if you know XKCD, but they have lovely comics. And one of the comics is, you know, like how difficult are different branches of physics, like Newtonian mechanics, you know, continuum mechanics, and then you have like quantum mechanics, and then you have like sand, because we don't understand sand. So what I meant with when I earlier mentioned powders in Brazil is that sometimes people are missing relevant data. So there were people that set up like a giant plans to make some of these powders, and it works completely fine in Europe, and then they had everything optimized and stuff, and then they started a new plant in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to try to pour the powder, but everything started caking. It was just one big lumpy mess.
Mm.
And in the end, what they thought was the difference is that humidity in Brazil is just way higher than this here, so the powder starts sticking together. And yeah, this is not even the only example, because it has also happened in chemistry. If you try to make, for example, you can make supramolecular polymers. So you have like discs floating around in a fluid, and they can stack to form like a fiber. And when they were doing some of these experiments, they found out that the results just keep flipping back and forth between two different results, basically. And then again, at some point, they started looking, and like I don't know how much time this took them, but they also found out that the humidity of water in the air was changing which one of these it was. So sometimes you can be sitting literally in your data and not realize it's there.
Going back to what we said earlier, so that is not meaningful data to you until you have that that light bulb moment.
Yes, sir. There's one more example I have. I mean, I think it's quite known under biologists, but for example, like mice, like short-lived rodents, their behavior changes with seasons, and whether it's sunlight or air pressure, or, you know, that doesn't—it's not the important part here. It's just that their behavior changes. So if you're doing a study on mice, you should actually also mention the season that you're doing the study in.
Mm-hmm. You
know? And I don't recall much that's like seen as a critical reporting variable, but something that maybe should be taken into account if their behavior changes.
Mm.
Would that be the same even in a lab environment, though?
Yes, I think so. I think they looked at this, and it was that the breeding behavior of the mice in the lab environment changed as well. But you know, the thing is that even if it's not, so if it is a variable outside of the lab environment, you should first prove that it's not a variable inside the lab environment, of course. So I would then say, yeah, this is a potential interacting variable recorded.
Interesting. So is it common practice now to note the season in research or lab work to do with mice?
I don't know, to be honest.
Mm.
I also heard this from people here at Cambridge, that they noticed that the mice were doing differently, but I didn't ask whether they record it now.
Interesting. Again, so something like noting the seasons could be this light bulb moment, I suppose. And then,
yes.
Because that certainly relates to like ethnographic work, I suppose, in regards to things like data definition or when data start or when data ends. And I had this conversation with my supervisor. So for instance, for me, because I was very clear in what my research was, partly because COVID had to force a narrower scope. As soon as I got out of the aeroplane, because I did my fieldwork in Singapore, where I'm from, as soon as I got out of the aeroplane, that to me is like research began. Everything is interesting to me. As opposed to if I had, the original plan was to be a year in another country where you probably spend the first couple weeks or months sort of sitting in the culture and getting to know more of the surroundings. It's a bit of a looser definition, and then maybe you'll start recording in your field notes, but it's not meaningful yet until you have that light bulb moment where, actually, I'm going to write about this and that. Therefore, this time that I was set in a cafe just observing wasn't meaningful then, but it's meaningful now because something happened. So I think that's maybe something that is relevant to both the STEMs and the arts and humanities and social sciences, whereas sometimes how you define data or what your frame or your scope of data is essentially what makes data meaningful. And before that, it's just before, for example, going back to my example, before I knew that sitting in that cafe was meaningful data, I was just having a coffee, writing things down. But now, because I've had a new perspective, that light bulb moment, suddenly like, oh, this is about my research. And I think that's also the important thing about storing the notebooks, I suppose, because maybe a few years down the road, you have a new research perspective and you can go back. I guess this is a sort of a plug for our own services in research data management and data management plans, because if you sort of have that all stored nicely and neatly, then you can go back 5 years later to something that's only recently meaningful and go back to that old data because it's just been sort of managed properly, and then you can actually make that data meaningful as opposed to everything's a mess unless there's a very direct relevance. So it kind of reduces bad data management, basically reduces your scope of the data or the application of your data. So yeah, so there's a self-plug for the University Research Data Management Services.
Yeah, it's very funny how sometimes you end up seeing something turns out to be useful in the end. I find it very funny. I mean, this is also in statistics to say the best moment to do an experiment to plan an experiment is after you've done it, you know? And similarly, sometimes you see these people, like I had a colleague some time ago who was like, this doesn't completely make sense. And then he had to go back papers until it was somewhere in the 1920s or 30s. And then the paper was in German. It was it was good that I know German, because otherwise I would not be able to read this. It turned out to be very important for his work. So it's I'm happy it was archived at least, you know.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting thing to share. And I've always wondered about that as well. I think that there is a lot of talk about the English language, especially with AI, for instance, and coding languages, a lot of it's in English. So it seems to be, I wouldn't say limitation, but there's maybe there's a limitation to a particular language. All this investment and this current move towards AI and coding is all mainly in the English language. There might be a potential coder out there who doesn't speak English, and then, you know, tapping into their resource, I guess, so to speak. That's interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's also in my field, my work, the techniques, the simulation techniques I use are also used in geotechnical engineering. And China does a lot of stuff on geotechnical engineering. And then sometimes I come across an article and it's it's in Mandarin Chinese. Oh, yeah. I'm just hoping this is not too important for me. You know, I can't read it, and probably translating it is going to be very difficult. So yeah, although I do feel that even pretty much everywhere in the world, they're moving towards English in that sense.
Mm-hmm. It's almost a sort of a ethno-linguistic sort of / geopolitic concern to this, then, I suppose, where maybe they will benefit by not having their research in English if they wanted. Not to say that someone like you can just learn English, or that you can't use AI as opposed to just feed something to a machine to get it translated. But I guess that's that first barrier, I suppose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It would be nice if I can translate it though, but I haven't figured out yet how to.
This is probably a good segue to the export control question. The idea of it would be interesting to know, going back to your situation of working with data across the border. I just wanted to know what the challenges you face. Was there challenges importing or exporting? How did you curate your data in such a way that it could be brought out or worked across the border?
Oh yeah, so in this case, all of this was actually done in the Netherlands. So both Eindhoven and the hospital, and we were in the Netherlands. So we didn't have to deal with exporting data between countries or such. But we did, of course, have to move our data from the hospital, like the university hospital, basically, to the other university, Eindhoven. And in that case, always the way to transfer such data is either through a media or a platform that has been approved by either institution, but if you have to get both institutions to agree, that's kind of, you know, it's kind of tricky. So for us, the easiest way and safest way was just to get an encrypted hard drive, put it on there, and physically move it.
Were there any concerns about the data, physical data, being on the move or anything like that, the actual transport of it?
Well, the physical data being on the move is not so much a problem as long as it's encrypted. So it had to be like, there were like, it's like if you meet certain encryption standards and you have a strong password, then it's not so much a problem if the data is on the move, because even if it gets lost, you know, they can't get it, it's encrypted.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I watch Mission Impossible, I've always thought the feasibility of having technology like that where it could self-destruct in 5 seconds. So if you get the wrong passcode, it'd be like, you got the wrong passcode. This hard drive was self-destruct in 5 seconds. Like, it's actually a pretty cool technology if it existed, and probably very beneficial for data transporting and exporting going forward.
Yeah, I think there are some systems that I don't think there will be many, but there are some that you can say, okay, you know, after 5 failed attempts, delete the entire drive or something. Mm. It's basically a similar thing, but then digitally.
It makes it hard for someone like me who sometimes needs like 6 attempts to get my password.
Yeah, and make sure you're like, better check caps lock 5 times.
Yeah, exactly. So this has been a very interesting conversation so far. I think we're about 40 minutes in, so maybe we can start to wrap up soon. So I just want to ask this second question to you, the idea about your relationship to data. So, and you can answer this obviously in any way you want, but what do you think is your relationship to data?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because I guess I see my relationship to data more as a role that I play with respect to the data. Like And I have quite a few many roles that I cycle through. For example, like, I mean, obviously I'm the data generator in the lab. Then at some point I'm the data processor and I'm working on it. And then I am the data manager when I'm storing it or when I'm trying to make my data sets open access. So yeah, I think I would, to me that varies. And I see it more like as a functional role. I mean, all of my research depends on data.
I wonder, when you deal with like ECG raw data, from ECG raw data to a very personal identifiable sort of data, does it start to shift? Does the data itself start to be more or less humanized along the way? Or do you always see it as you're working on someone, a living, breathing human being? Or does that only happen towards the end of that spectrum?
Well, I think I very much have like the stereotypical scientist mindset in that way. To me, like what I'm working on it at the moment, like it's just numbers to me. And then I'm dealing with it, and it eventually turns into like personal and health data. And then I also become the data safeguarder or protector in that sense. And I definitely do feel that responsibility. But also trying to bias myself. Mm-hmm. I also try not to really make a personal connection with the data in any sense. If you kind of get what I mean with that.
Mm-hmm. The more you give a face to something, the more you may sort of elicit an unconscious bias of some sort.
Yeah, I think it's. You know, so this is always the thing, right? I mean, when dealing with people and human data, it can be very noisy. So to control tests properly, you would like to be double blind. You would like to know, you would like not to know who did a certain test. You would like not to know the answer beforehand, more or less, as in who's fit, more fit or something. But sometimes, you know, you're the same person as the person who collected the data. So you cannot avoid knowing that. But there are ways that you can trick yourself to avoid that. For example, you know, you label the data in a certain clever way and you make sure that the labeling is only something that you see afterwards, or such kind of procedures. Like it's, like even if you go to like very dry cut, physical lab data, for example, microscopy of my powders or something. You can, like, the person recording it can introduce a significant bias because of just how they tap the microscopy slide when there's powder on it. Oh, now suddenly I'm making an image of two particles that are touching instead of three that are separate. And I think it's also kind of the duty I see that when I do research to make the data and the required, the how I acquire it and how it's processed, to be as independent of the user as possible, because otherwise user variation is going to overlap my results. And that's not something I want, because I want to look at the science itself, not who did the science.
Mm-hmm. In the sense, in terms of the sort of accuracy needed for your line of research, the more dehumanized the data is, the more accurate the data, so to speak.
Yes, I don't like the phrasing of dehumanized, but
fair enough.
I guess I would say, I would not say dehumanized. I would say the less personal data is, as in the less person specific.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense. Or maybe we should be talking not about person-specific, but operator-specific.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that does. Yeah. I agree. That does sound a lot.
Yeah.
Sound
better. Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you have heart rate data of someone, you know, that is very personal, that is very human data. But you do not, I do not want to get a different diagnosis if I go to a different doctor. Ideally, I get the same diagnosis with every doctor. So the operator, more or less, the doctor, should not matter, but the data of me should matter. And that's how I would view it.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally.
Yeah. So to be objective, as objective as possible.
Yeah, in mm-hmm. the science frame, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's anything you think that in regards to the sort of line of the conversation we've been having so far, anything that you think you should mention or want to mention?
Yeah, I don't think I have a very strong, you know, final phrase. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps what I learned most is that the meaning of data can change immensely. And the only way you're going to know that is to know what you're dealing with very well, to deal with your, to know your systems, you know, either the physics or the medicine. I feel that there's a lot of focus now on data science and on machine learning, but I can't help but feel always that you're not going to get the best out of that if you don't know the situation itself and how to deal. I think that's my main takeaway.
That's a good takeaway. I would say that's a pretty good closing thought. So thank you for that. I just want to give you an opportunity to plug whatever you want to plug. I know your research, you won an award recently. You've got your startup. So anything you want the listener to know about you?
No, not in particular. I'm moving along right now. I mean, I'm pretty busy with getting this thesis written in my last year. So I don't have a particular thing I want to promote now. But if you are interested in something I mentioned in particular, I'm very free to have coffee sometime and talk about it.
That's great. Thank you, Danny. Thank you for your time.
And thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure to be able to have this conversation with you.